From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Later in this show, you'll hear a story I did from South Africa, where I described taking a trip to a town about an hour west of Cape Town. However, what I meant to say was an hour north of Cape Town. An hour west of Cape Town would have put me in the Atlantic Ocean. We regret the error. Every year about this time, we invite Pointer's Craig Silverman of Regret the Error to try to make our mistakes seem paltry by comparison. Craig, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you. And that is a rather paltry but nice to hear a corrected mistake.
This year's list begins with a mistake that we saw a lot, and it had to do with the death of Osama bin Laden.
Yes, and I noticed that you slowed down when you started to say his name because that was sort of the root of the error. They would end up saying Obama bin Laden or, you know, Obama has been killed. And it was on TV, it was on the radio, it was online, it was in newspapers, and it was really kind of relentless.
Senator Barack Obama's campaign has been dogged with false rumors, among them that Osama is a Muslim. Obama, rather.
They prefer to think of a guy named Osama bin Laden. Not Osama. There I make the mistake. Barack Obama.
The report says that Osama bin Laden.
I think unfortunate name, Obama.
Well, I have a great respect for Jesse Jackson, that he was an important figure in paving the way for an Osama bin Laden to appear.
And the black comedy of errors continued in the newspapers with the publication of images alleged to be the corpse of Osama bin Laden, but
they were, of course, photoshopped. There has been no photo released. And yet, in particular, a bunch of tabloids in England went with this very clearly photoshopped image of Osama bin Laden, and it was supposedly him dead. It was not. And it ended up really resulting in some pretty notable errors as well.
NPR was not immune to your list. And a very somber story, the shooting in Arizona that led to the reported death of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. What happened?
There was a lot of confusion at the scene. She wasn't the only person who was shot. There were a lot of people who were shot. There was a lot of misinformation that comes out naturally whenever there's chaos. And so NPR heard from a source who was related to a congressional office, and they heard from a source who was related to the local sheriff's office in Arizona. Both these people said, well, she's dead. And it turned out later that, in fact, they were just sort of reporting what they had heard. Neither of them had actual confirmation. And so NPR ended up going with that. It was put on their website. It started to be broadcast. And then eventually it was also tweeted from the main NPR account. All those things together really started spreading the news. And pretty soon you had other news outlets like CNN and Reuters and others that were also reporting that she had been killed.
You have a lot of different categories in your annual compendium. One of them is the best, not correction of the year, but clarification, which is a slightly different beast. This one's from India's Early Times newspaper, itself apparently a victim of some sort of ongoing online hoax.
It was a strange one, and it was kind of lovely in some ways as well, in particular for the use of language. They said that they were informing our esteemed readers that certain unscrupulous elements, out of sheer frustration and jealousy, have created a fake email ID, and that ID is being used to send fake mails containing news reports published in Early Times. The clarification goes on to note that the sender seemingly copies news reports from the website, adds certain derogatory remarks, and then sends it to media organizations. But my favorite part of the clarification comes at the end. It is clarified that the urchin doing this has no association with Early Times, and apparent aim of this insane behavior is to create a wedge and animosity between Early Times and two other prominent media outlets. I think the use of urchin as an insult on its own wins the prize.
We're going to play you a little tape here for your plagiarism episode of the year. You know, sometimes these plagiarism things are a bit murky. You know, did they really plagiarize, or did they get the same idea? Or maybe did they just borrow a phrase here and there and forget to attribute it? Not this story.
Folks at ABC News really kind of couldn't believe their ears and their eyes. What happened is that the folks at that station in New Zealand basically took the script for the ABC piece. They substituted in a New Zealand family, a New Zealand reporter, a New Zealand host to basically repeat the same lines that ABC News had done.
Figure out what in your own home is actually made in New Zealand.
What do you own that is actually made in the US?
Helping to preserve Kiwi jobs.
Preserving American jobs.
Tonight, one Kiwi family faces the truth about foreign goods.
And tonight, one family faces the truth about foreign goods.
We searched all over the country for one very brave and willing American family.
We searched all over the country for one very courageous and willing Kiwi family.
Like so many other families who told our producers their house must be filled with plenty that's made in America.
They were like so many other families who told our producers they own lots that's made in New Zealand.
I mean, it's the most brazen case of a plagiarism I've ever seen involving TV. They did basically a remake. You could call it an homage, except they didn't have permission to do it.
Finally, you have a correction and an apology for a misattribution. This concerned the pop artist Tony Braxton.
So here's the correction that was published by the New York Post. The Post incorrectly attributed a quote to Tony Braxton in an article published on March 25th. Braxton did not say, quote, "I have a big ass house, three cars, and I fly first class all around the world. Some say I have the perfect life."
Let's just say Tony Braxton never said that. Who did?
That is the eternal question for this year, I suppose. Who did say they have a big-ass house and three cars and fly first class all around the world? Maybe it was somebody at the New York Post.
Maybe. Craig, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is the author of Regret the Error blog at pointer.org. Craig, if we're having this conversation, I guess that means Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Thank you. It seems a shame to end the year fixating on what went wrong for the press in 2011. So let's now take a peek ahead at what will go wrong in 2012. Joining me is Alan Mutter, the inveterate editor who writes the industry blog Reflections of a Newsasaur. Mutter believes that if you are a local legacy media company, newspaper, broadcast station, Yellow Pages, 2012 will be the year when the digital giants show up in town to eat your lunch. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Tell me about lunch.
There are a number of people coming to the trough. Google is taking a greater interest in putting feet on the street in a number of markets to teach people how to build websites, help them get domain names, and show them how to do online advertising so they don't have to spend money in the Yellow Pages or the local paper. Fewer than 10% of most local businesses are now using Google ad services, so there's quite a big upside for Google in making that sort of investment. And I should point out that Google's ad revenues this year in 2011 will be about $36 billion, or 1.5 times bigger than all of the newspapers and all the land put together.
Now salesmen will call at the door of the hardware store or the barbershop or the pizzeria and say, let me tell you how to work this internet thing.
It's already happening. The next thing that's happening is that Amazon is getting very aggressive about trying to go after both the customers of Main Street merchants and even big mall merchants, the big box stores like Best Buy. They released this great new shopping app that came out over Christmas that allows you to be standing in Best Buy and take a picture of the barcode for the TV and find it cheaper online and push to buy before you can even get out of the store. If their business begins to contract, they're going to have less money to spend on advertising. That affects the media companies because these are the guys who buy the ads in local newspapers and on local radio and TV.
Okay, let's talk about television.
Next year is going to be a great year for TV because of all the political advertising. It's going to be a very expensive election, probably the most ever. But what's happening underneath is that lots of people are trying to connect the internet seamlessly to the big screen in the den. That will really start to further fragment the audiences now assembled by local broadcasters. As more and more things happen to give consumers choice about where to get programming and how to buy programming, this is going to have a huge impact on not only local broadcasters, but even local cable companies who now have very high-priced bundles of channels. somewhere down the road, they're going to be forced to unbundle. And when that happens, all those expensive local cable systems, which now generate profits of around 50%, are going to become not money machines, but actually albatrosses. This year, we've seen people begin to cut the cord and discontinue expensive bundles of cable TV services because people have more and more choices. This has almost never happened before in the history of the cable business.
And I want to leave this with newspapers. As you look at what we have experienced the last 10 years, and as you look ahead at 2012, any thoughts for a present or future business model for monetizing the newspaper industry?
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
The people who run newspapers are going to have to learn a lot about creating little islands of content and connecting exactly the right audience with the right advertiser in the moment. That's what Google has done so brilliantly. That is the success of the company. But I believe that there's a future for newspaper publishing companies if they become the owners of the definitive base of information about consumers and the markets that they serve. But it requires a big investment that quite a number of publishers have yet to make.
Yeah, one more thing, Alan. In the summer, I'd like to spray my patio furniture, and I'd like to put down newspaper first, you know.
Right.
Will I have any to put down?
You may in the immediate future, but we are starting to see publishers cut back on the number of days a week that they publish. And also we're seeing some publishers cut back on the days of the week that they do home delivery. Both of the big dailies in Detroit print a paper every day, but they only deliver to your home 3 days a week, the 3 days of the week that advertisers really want. So that's kind of a strange and interesting transition.
All right, Alan, Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Alan Mutter writes the Reflections of a Newsasaur blog. He spoke to us from San Francisco. Coming up, one tip for hosting a good comments section is to treat it like you're hosting a dinner party. Would you let your guests hurl insults at each other? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, the New York Times overhauled its online commenting system, much to the chagrin of some of its readers. The changes included threading comments so readers can reply directly to one another and the creation of a trusted commenter system, which allows users with the elite trusted status to post to the site immediately without being filtered by a moderator. The resistance to the new system might have more to do with the general resistance to change online than with the system itself, but the fact remains that comment sections online are some of the least innovative parts of the Internet, and websites still haven't figured out a good way to deal with them. Rebecca Rosen is an associate editor and blogger at The Atlantic. She says more than a decade in, Internet comment sections continue to be terrible.
I think the promise of the Internet is the ability to have these wide-ranging conversations that reach so many people. But right now we have a system where the post really has its place on the pedestal, and then the conversations with everyone else are relegated to kind of this long list at the end of the post. We haven't really figured out a way to have that back and forth in a way that's easily digestible for other readers and for the authors of the post themselves.
And a lot of that has to do with the noise within the comment threads. You've got trolls in there with malice or inanity just to get a rise out of the readers. You've got ideologues who use the opportunity just to flog their worldview irrespective of what the original post even was about. You've got assertions made with certainty but no evidence whatsoever. Actual paranoids and obsessives.
Anytime you have user-generated content, you're going to have some bad apples. But if you look at a site like YouTube, it doesn't matter how many bad videos are on YouTube because there are filtering mechanisms that allow the good videos to rise to the top and allows viewers to go find those videos easily. It's not really about getting rid of the noise. It's about finding the signal and elevating it. That's the challenge of building a better comment system.
We're only about 15 years into this whole comment ecosystem. it strikes me that it hasn't changed a whole lot.
That's right. I think this has been one of the neglected problems of the internet for two reasons. One is that having a wide-ranging conversation among large groups of people is not an easy thing to do. I haven't really seen it work well off the internet, and I've only seen it work well on the internet in a few instances. And the second thing is I think that for a lot of places, creating good comment sections has just not been a priority for their developers. Building better content and promoting that content have really been the priorities of magazines, newspapers, other websites.
Probably the best way that sites so far have found to denude the comment sections of nonsense is human monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, tedious and expensive, I guess.
Right. I think there is basically no replacement for some kind of human editing. But there's an open question about whether that monitoring needs to be done by someone on the staff of a publication or if it can be done by the community where they vote up and down comments and really do act as that same filtering mechanism. I think it also can build a community of commenters that can encourage over the long term more interesting conversations because people begin to know each other and people can develop cultural touchstones and jokes and things like that. So I think that having some kind of human input for filtering comments is useful. It just doesn't necessarily have to come from the publication itself.
You have some best practices. Who's doing what you really like?
One system is the Reddit or Slashdot system where you have these communal voting mechanisms and good quality conversations kind of coalesce around the top comments. On our own site at The Atlantic, the commenters on Ta-Nehisi Coates' blog are regarded as kind of the cream of the crop. And it really draws people to our site because the conversation is so interesting. That said, it's a lot of time on his part to edit and curate the comment section to bring it to that level. So that's not necessarily something that's widely replicable for other sites and blogs.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Rosen is an associate editor and blogger at The Atlantic. Rosen's colleague, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where his blog draws visitors both for the posts and the extremely engaging comment section. And the reason, Coates says, is that he moderates the hell out of it. And unlike the trolls and instigators he invites to go away, the ones who stay leave very thoughtful commentary.
I mean, it's not just this sort of stereotype of people just in their mom's basement eating Cheetos or whatever. It so often is really, really not that. You get some really smart people.
Your blog is often held out as a sterling example of how to incorporate comments without being, you know, taken over by them. What's your approach?
The only thing I really think about is what I would like to read. I always tell people it's like a dinner party, and I try to host it that way. I try to keep the conversation interesting. In terms of what is the bane of all comment sections, and that is, you know, rude commentary, people going over the line, trolling, that sort of thing, I generally follow the same rules. So I always tell people, if you were in my house and you insulted one of my guests, I would ask you to leave. I don't understand why it would be any different in a comment section.
Well, the criticism against that sort of policing is that it's anti-democratic and that it somehow undermines the diversity of opinion and thought and so forth.
It does all of those things. It does all those things. But the beauty of the web is that whatever my comment section is, it's not the internet. So if that's not what you want, you can go somewhere else. The web is open. The web is free. It's only in this particular corner that it is, in fact, totalitarian, anti-democratic. there is no the diversity of opinion is rather small. I would certainly cop to that.
So what can't I do on your blog that I can do in the comments section of the more free-for-all variety?
You can't call people names. I mean, you can't say, listen, you idiot. You can't change the topic because you don't like the discussion. So if we're talking about Mitt Romney's approach to gay marriage, you can't say, well, Barack Obama said the same thing. You can't do the reverse. If we're talking about Barack Obama's approach to gay marriage, you can't say, yeah, but Mitt Romney said the same thing. It's like you're more curating comments. So what you're trying to do is present a conversation that's interesting, not for everyone, but for a certain small group of people. But I don't have like a code of conduct for what people can do. But it's very instinctive to me. I was tempted to make the pornography argument to say, I don't know what it is, but when I see it, I know what it is. My only criteria is that you have a civil, interesting conversation.
Now, this does not take no time. How much do you invest in keeping the conversation civil and directed?
Too much. Way too much. And more than I ever expected. I invest at least as much time in curating and in hosting as I do in actual writing. It can get really, really hectic. Blogging will burn you out, period. I think blogging plus having to curate definitely is a load. And I'm of the mind that it's not something that somebody should do for the rest of their life.
So you're, you know, somewhere in an inner circle of hell. You have a blog, but no time. Do you open one door in which there is no comment section because you haven't the resources to deal with it? Or do you open the other, which is the unmoderated fray, and just let the chips fall where they may?
I'm going with no comments. I wouldn't even hesitate. This is just in terms of my opinion. An unmoderated fray is no comments.
Now, there is the blog, which I guess is the point of departure for the discussion. Mm-hmm. And then there's the commentator's weigh in.
Right.
Are they separate things, or is the actual product the blog plus the commentary inexorably intertwined?
To me, it is a whole thing. For many years before I wrote for the web, I wrote for print. And in general, there weren't comments. There were letters to the editor that people curated. And when I started reading blogs for the first time, and even in newspapers, when they would publish online, they would open up their comment sections. You would have this thoroughly researched, or at least an attempt at a thoroughly researched piece. And below it, you would have the worst sort of ad hominem, the worst back and forth. Your mother's this, you did this, you black this and that. It was as though you went to an art museum and, you know, some kid had scrawled below the picture, you know, Mikey was here or something like that. I mean, it really actually detracted from the content of the piece. And I look at the commentary below the blog post as content. I look at it as a space where people spend their time after they finish reading whatever I've written. So to me, it is a whole thing.
Sometimes I so want to answer back the commenters, and I write something, shall we say, pointed, and have to struggle with myself mm-hmm. not to hit send. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And sometimes I fail in that struggle, mm-hmm. and I get involved in a back and forth that I just don't want to be a part of.
Right.
When do you hit delete and when do you hit send?
So I hit send far too much. The first job I ever had in journalism, we would publish, as most newspapers or magazines or whatever do, letters to the editor that were dissents. The publication I was at, they didn't allow writers to respond. And the point was, you had the gun. You had the platform. You had the cannon. Are you so petty that you have to go back and forth with somebody in the letters section in addition to already having to write as long as you got to write? I always try to remember that I have the cannon. I very often forget that, though. And if I go over the line, if I say something too mean, I apologize for it. And worse is, sometimes you're actually wrong. And I guess this is the value to answering, right? To answering when people come after you. I've gone back and forth on 20 responses, then at the end realized, you know what, I was wrong. And then had to write a post about why I was wrong. I don't think people expect you to be perfect, but I do think they want you to be honest.
Far be it from me to give you advice, but in future,
mm-hmm.
don't be wrong.
Easier said than done.
Ta-Nehisi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is a senior editor and blogger at The Atlantic. Writer and critic Lee Siegel did something very, very wrong. Back in 2006, Siegel was so infuriated by the flaming he was taking on the New Republic's website and its policy for writers not to intervene that he began answering the ugliest criticism in an online comment section under a pseudonym. He got caught, was suspended from his job, and treated as vain and ridiculous. Since then, he's thought deeply on the subject and written a book titled Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Electronic Mob. Here's an interview we first ran back in 2008.
I was called names that I can't really repeat on your show, but at one point someone called me a pedophile, not using that language. And I thought, you know, enough is enough. I called one of my editors and I complained about it. And they said, well, you know, this is just the way it is. You can love it or leave it. And I just answered out of exasperation and on principle, and of course out of my foolish pride, when I gave them tit for tat, and the whole thing blew up, and really wasn't a very bad ending. I wrote a book, the policy at the New Republic changed. Online anonymity is part of the debate now. Every cloud has a silver lining.
What was the pseudonym you used in responding to this guy?
I chose the pseudonym Sprezzatura. By the way, I did nothing to hide my style because I did not want Sprezzatura to take credit for my best lines.
That's ironic. Tell us what Sprezzatura means.
Well, it connotes a kind of deceptive simplicity. It's a term from the Italian Renaissance. It's a way to be artful while seeming natural.
Well done. How did you get outed?
Some very, very busy and industrious commenters went back and actually did a textual analysis of my own writing and compared it to what Sprezzatura was saying and Eureka.
We've talked in general terms about how people inveigh on the web, especially when they're given the opportunity for anonymity. But it's not just nasty talk that's so frustrating. I mean, you know, it's not just name-calling. My experience is it's also, intellectual dishonesty, playing fast and loose with the truth, essentially not following the rules, not playing fair in debate or discourse. Does that drive you crazy as well?
Yeah, internet boosters are always talking about how the internet shatters old hierarchies. But that's nonsense. What the internet's creating is a new kind of hierarchy, where the loudest and most aggressive voices drown out or bully into silence the most patient and reflective voices. Of course, it just makes me very exasperated to see people come online and just venting an opinion. As a critic, I'm aware of the fact that criticism has very little to do with passing judgment. The fun of criticism, the thrill, the pleasure of it, is how you get to your judgment, through wit, through argument, through style, through historical analysis. But these people come online and they just vent an opinion, and it's a clamor of opinions, and it becomes incoherent.
People talk about the Platonic ideal of the democratic web, but it strikes me to be more along the lines of Lord of the Flies and reverting to human nature in a very ugly way.
Exactly. It's very schoolyard. You know, the whole dynamic behind the internet is really to appeal to our impulses, to appeal to our id. The internet is really a product of commercial society. You know, you get on, you click, you use your finger, you can get what you want when you want it. You can indulge any impulse the minute you feel it. There's no inhibition. And that's really the ideal shopper. But applied to human relations, it's disastrous.
So what's the solution for all of this? If we can agree that the internet has changed the social dynamic in many, many ways and has kind of turned the power of all institutions upside down, and the idea that individuals are now free to weigh in is so attractive in so many ways, how can that power be harnessed, the power of the individual to express a viewpoint for good instead of commotion?
Well, in terms of people just venting their opinions, I really have to take a very unpopular position here and say I don't see how that can be harnessed for good. I don't know what good comes of that kind of clamor. It makes these individuals feel good. It gives them the illusion that they're being read. But any newspaper or magazine editor will tell you, with a winking aside, that nobody's reading these threads except the people who are on them. It's really, for the most part, a kind of cynical, commercial tactic that a lot of newspapers and magazines are using because they think it's going to help them survive. It's not helping them survive, in fact. And I think more and more, as journalists get laid off, as the internet begins to cripple newspapers and magazines, these powerful journalists who have lost their jobs are going to start speaking out against it as opposed to pandering to it, which they've been doing for the past 10, 15 years.
Lee, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Siegel now writes for The Daily Beast and is the author most recently of Harvard is Burning. This interview first aired in 2008. Last week, just in time for the holidays, South African President Jacob Zuma lashed out at Christianity and at modernity itself for undermining ancient African traditions. This outburst sparked the ire of the South African Christian Church for what they see as Zuma's increasingly retrograde conduct.
In October, in a bid to assuage key trading partner China, Zuma's government denied a visa to the Dalai Lama, who had wished to join Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the cleric's 80th birthday, this prompting Tutu to condemn the ruling African National Congress.
This government is worse than the apartheid government, because at least you were expecting it with the apartheid government.
And only last month, Zuma and the ANC passed a secrecy law that would criminalize disclosure of sensitive government information, even if the revelations uncover government corruption, dishonesty, or incompetence. 17 years after the largely peaceful overthrow of apartheid rule, South Africa seems to be at a crossroads as the corrupted Zuma administration struggles to deliver jobs, education, and even the most basic services to its poorest citizens. One safeguard against eroding democracy is South Africa's lively free press, which roots out scandal and hypocrisy on a breathtaking scale. That is, the private free press. The country's largest media organization, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, controlled by the ANC, was supposed to be the shining beacon of democracy. But is it? Coming up, we consider today's SABC.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. 2 months ago, I went to Johannesburg, South Africa, to take the measure of the media scene and particularly the nation's biggest media outlet. What follows is a rebroadcast of those reports. For an analysis of the press environment in the 17 years since the end of apartheid rule in South Africa, it would be hard to be any more succinct than Jeremy Maggs, news host and media analyst for the independent broadcaster E! News.
It's gritty, it's rugged, it's determined, and it gets up the nose of everybody.
Chief among those irritated noses is the ruling African National Congress Party, which has dominated government since the 1994 end of the great anti-apartheid struggle. Once upon a time, ANC leaders were the unequivocal good guys, liberators of a nation, and authors of perhaps the most inclusive, individually empowering constitution ever written. Now they are the authors of breathtaking corruption, political infighting, scandalous failure to deliver basic services to the poorest citizens, increasingly brutal responses to civil protests, and a growing intolerance for criticism. Maggs and the rest of the South African media establishment see a gathering storm of press intimidation via proposals for a new secrecy law and the formation of a media appeals tribunal as a government arbiter of press excess.
This revolutionary party, now a ruling party, increasingly finds itself on the wrong side of the masses whose interests they claim to promote.
That's Jimmy Matthews, head of TV news at the South African Broadcasting Company, or SABC, which controls 3 of 4 national channels.
The contradiction is that the ruling party, the ANC, is responsible to a large degree for delivering this constitution that we have. And so one would expect that they would be the champions to defend this, but in reality they are politicians.
That allegation of political opportunism has long since ceased being controversial. Whether the episode was former President Thabo Mbeki's AIDS denialism, or his coddling of Zimbabwe dictator Robert Mugabe, or current kickback scandals totaling in the hundreds of millions of dollars, the ANC has repeatedly appeared, in a word, un-Mandela-like. What is controversial, however, is the SABC's standing as a critic of politics as usual.
SABC Radio and Television,
You always take their stories with a pinch of salt.
Joe Twole is South Africa's press ombudsman.
Sadly, the SABC, which in fact should be the crown of journalism in this country, isn't doing what it should be doing.
The proposed press laws, Twole says, whether passed or not, invite self-censorship in what he sees as precisely the SABC model. He's not alone in that view. William Byrd, director of the public interest group Media Monitoring Africa, says the organization is weighted down with hundreds of political appointees, called cadres, whose sole qualification is service to the ANC.
I've spoken to producers who've said that ministers phoned them and said, we want this person on air, where the pressure is as direct as that. But there's a perceived implication that they would want us to do this, so we'll make sure that we follow that line.
Or, Byrd says, made-to-order coverage for people in high places wishing to grind an axe on SABC. When the respected Mail and Guardian newspaper questioned a government contract let to an oligarch named Robert Goumede, the SABC quickly ran a 2.5-minute story consisting mainly of Goumede's wild, never-substantiated accusations, including bribery and racism, against the newspaper reporter. Here's how it sounded on SABC.
He alleges the Mail and Guardian newsman Sam Soul was paid by Stellenbosch to write the damaging stories about him.
Here's a payment made out to a so-called investigative journalist who goes out to attack black people to say that they are corrupt, they bribe people.
Goumede says he's being vilified by the paper because of his public support for the ANC and a suspicion that as a black man, he must have acquired his wealth dubiously.
Response from the Mail and Guardian was presented as an 8-second perfunctory denial.
This news is brought to you by SABC.
In its earliest post-apartheid days, the SABC was the aggressive, courageous, muckraking news organization it had never been under minority white rule. But this critical source of news, information, and entertainment for South Africa's population of nearly 50 million has gradually drifted away from the public broadcasting role mandated in its charter.
Because the new governors could not let go of the power that they saw that the previous government, that the apartheid government had over the public broadcaster, which is a very powerful medium.
Mondli Makanya is group editor-in-chief of the newspaper group Avusa and chairperson of the South Africa Editors Forum.
So you can imagine the temptation, you can imagine how they salivate at the ability to do that. So they soon turned the public broadcaster back into the state broadcaster, something that actually is a pale shadow of what we all hoped it would be.
All this criticism, Jimmy Matthews, head of news at SABC-TV, has heard many times before.
SABC is everyone's favorite whipping boy, and, you know, that comes with the turf. There seems also to me to be a notion, and I think it's a cheap notion, that to be independent, you have to be critical of government at all costs.
No, you have to be willing to be critical of government at all costs.
And that I agree with. And I think that we have been. And I don't think that the SABC is often given credit for that.
He cites, for instance, the April police killing of a protester in the town of Ficksburg in the Free State, an episode the SABC happened to be on hand to record and which it broadcast most graphically the same evening.
It started as a peaceful march, but there was little doubt that many residents were angry. They were demanding action from a municipality they say have constantly ignored their calls to deliver. The resulting scuffle was both brutal and shocking.
Though the authorities were shaken by such reporting and let that be known to Matthew's superiors, he says it's not necessarily explicit interference that makes his job difficult.
And I have a newsroom filled with poorly trained reporters where there is no real incentive to go out and break stories. I find a newsroom that is subjected to the demands of the trade unions where the first recourse to criticism is to call the union rep. That the place is littered with party hacks is without dispute.
Recently, a mid-level editor suggested covering a run-of-the-mill ANC press conference.
I said, unless you can actually tell me what this press conference is about. Yes, we will attend the press conference if we think it's important, and it would be a part of a bigger story. But the press conference on its own does not qualify. I'd hardly got to my desk when my phone rang, and it was an ANC person calling saying, oh, I believe you don't cover our press conferences anymore.
Matthew says he struggles daily to navigate the many political, budgetary, commercial, and personnel obstacles in his path because he believes SABC can and must do better.
I've been shot at. I've been slapped about by the apartheid police. Had cell doors slammed shut behind me. I do what I do voluntarily. I'm not a member of a political organization. I think even those critical of the work I do, if they criticize the journalism, that's fine. I have a very clear view of what journalism I will try to leave behind. And every day is a struggle. I haven't had a single easy day.
To this lament, however, at least one ex-SABCer is unimpressed.
What marginal benefit is there if your two choices are a genuine propagandist versus a Jeremy Matthews who is basically a human being walking around with a vision in his head, but there's nothing that the millions of viewers see when they tune into the telly?
Eusebius McKeyser was an outspoken and confrontational host of the SABC political interview show Interface when he bluntly challenged the Minister of Justice.
It took just a couple of phone calls from one of the minister's team who were unhappy at the grilling that I had given him, the Minister of Justice, and then the sort of soft technique to get one out of the building started kicking in.
He can't prove that stepping on powerful toes ended his SABC career, but he believes it was the precipitating event for a series of decisions that he says ultimately compelled his resignation. Jeremy Maggs, the media critic at competing E! News, can't speak to the particulars of that episode, but the story sounds to him, also an ex-SABC host, all too familiar. So, too, the intimidation it implies.
You talk about the gathering storm. I think it's a lot more than that. I think the storm has already arrived. I think it's raining, to be quite honest with you. And I just hope that the umbrellas that we've got are, you know, strong enough to withstand all the drops that are coming our way.
The SABC sits atop a hill in Johannesburg, two circa 1960 office towers connected by a warren of corridors, dark, weary, and institutional. The whole complex looms over the city. As I walked outside into the southern hemisphere spring, clouds literally hovered at the tower's rooftops. At that very moment, a big story was breaking. It involved the secret use of government funds to lease 86 cars, including top-of-the-line Mercedes, in violation of contracting rules. The purchaser? The SABC. In South Africa, where free expression is constitutionally enshrined, some of the most cutting opinion is freely expressed by two men who have battled two regimes in a variety of genders under four names. One of them is billed as South Africa's most famous white woman, the irrepressible Evita Bazaidenhout.
A journalist last week wrote that Jacob Zuma's government was corrupt and inept and was a kleptocracy. So we had to summons him to appear in front of the media tribunal. Of course, he apologized. He said he didn't mean to be libelous. I said, Scotty, you're not libelous. It's just that you disclosed a state secret.
Such an institution is Evita that in her rural hometown of Darling, an hour west of Cape Town, she is honored by a thoroughfare called Evita Bazaidenhout Boulevard. Quite a tribute, considering that, strictly speaking, Evita Bazaidenhout doesn't exist. She is a fictional character, the creation of playwright-performer-satirist Peter Dirk Ace. But when South Africa's foremost comedy transvestite dons the dress and wig and heels, lo and behold, Evita appears. And she is boulevard-worthy. Evita is Bill Maher in Dame Edna's clothing,
And the Sunday cabaret audiences here in Darling adore her.
Here comes Mrs. Evita Bazekinen.
Evita's character became famous in the apartheid period as a hilariously out-of-turn speaking wife of an Afrikaner cabinet minister. Now, after a bizarre personal and political journey as a worker and revolutionary, Evita has a different ruling class to embarrass.
She's no longer the minister's wife. She has, having gone through the kitchens of the ANC, because in 94 she lost her job as the ambassador and she started cooking for reconciliation.
Evita's alter ego, Peter Derkace.
So she's been in the kitchen, she's been their nanny, and she's been the babysitter for hundreds of little Zumazelas. So she comes very much from that point of view, trying to share with the majority of her audience, who are the white people, that they must stop being frightened, because there's nothing really to frighten. One of the lines she says, you must please understand, what I've observed is the ANC will investigate every cul-de-sac before they find the freeway.
He, she, they have come a long way from the P.W. Botha, South Africa, as the performer, his makeup baby-oiled away, almost wistfully recalls.
I had to be on my toes all the time. And doing the show in the mouth of the dragon, I would do a show in the Pretoria Opera House in 1985 with P.W. Botha up the road with the security police waiting for me behind the curtain. That's why I never left the stage. I would change on stage because if I went off stage, they might grab me.
17 years later, the tables have long since turned, but Evita Bazekinhout has more to ridicule than ever, to Peter Derkace's delight and to his accumulating horror. Jacob Zuma disappoints him, Julius Malema scares the daylights out of him, and the ANC asks to be made fools of every single day.
I am in clover, that's why I don't pay taxes, I pay royalties. Because they really give me so much. The only problem is that it is so third-rate. It is such, they're third-rate people with fourth-rate ideas.
Perhaps, but with first-rate lawyers. Back in Cape Town resides another famous anti-apartheid voice with an assumed name, the political cartoonist Zapiro, who has taken on the ANC and been rewarded with a defamation lawsuit from President Jacob Zuma himself. Two of them, actually. The latest followed Zuma's acquittal on suspicious procedural grounds of major corruption charges. That following Zuma's previous acquittal on rape charges stemming from an encounter with the HIV-positive daughter of the president's close friend. Here is Zapiro, a.k.a. Jonathan Shapiro.
I did a cartoon that was very, very tough. It looks as if he's about to rape Lady Justice.
Unsurprisingly, Zuma and his cronies, who were depicted as holding Lady Justice down, totally flipped out, and a good part of South Africa with them.
The furore around the cartoon was the biggest that's ever happened in South African cartooning. It was our equivalent here, I suppose, of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, furore that happened in Europe and then worldwide. It was huge. He sued me for, what was it, seven million rand.
Not to be confused with the 2006 lawsuit following Zuma's rape prosecution, when Zapiro ridiculed the politician's claim of protecting himself from HIV infection by showering after sex. The cartoon depicted Zuma with a shower head attached to his skull, where it has remained in virtually all of Zapiro's Zuma cartoons ever since. That suit was for 15 million South African rand.
Which was a world record for a cartoonist being sued. That was 15 million rand, which is, you know, 2 million US.
Mazel tov on the world record.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The case is set for trial next year, and Shapiro is nervous about it, hinging as it does on the question of dignity, which, like free expression, is guaranteed by the South African Constitution. But he says he's far more concerned by proposed press laws and the chilling effect they would have on bringing to light the massive problems of South African governance and society.
Instead of fixing those problems, instead of admitting quite how bad they are and trying to sort something out, what it appears to be is that they are trying to put a lid on the people who are exposing them. They're putting a lid on the whistleblowers, on the media, on anyone in civil society who's critical. They're trying to paint all those people as counter-revolutionaries, and they're trying to up the idea of dignity so that they can say, well, my dignity has been impinged by that press report. And I think that this is really mounting to the point where I'm not sure exactly, I can't, you know, forecast exactly when it's all going to explode. It's exploding in small, funny enough, there goes the noon gun, just as a graphic example of that.
Oh yeah. As he speaks, as if on cue, the noon cannon fires off of a Cape Town cliff, a centuries-old warning to seafarers of the rocky shoals ahead. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Bob Garfield. Happy New Year.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.